But let's see if we can finish off the book of Acts. It's been a long journey. We are now in Acts 28, and today we're going to spend some time really looking at how God invites his people to represent Christ through the relationships they build. And we've seen the Apostle Paul in his first missionary journey, his second missionary journey. Now, what essentially is like a third missionary journey, except it's in chains, in shackles. And, of course, we left him just having survived on the isle or the island of Malta. And as we'll see today, they now find out where they are. The sailors did not know where they landed till they met the people. And so they find themselves washed ashore. They begin spending time once again ministering to the people. Recognize he stays there for an extended period of time. And we see how God has kept his promise to keep them alive. Continues to bring Paul closer to Rome one step at a time, regardless of the circumstances that actually might interfere with his plan. And we also see a little bit more of Paul's relational side in terms of how he's ministering to those, not only in Malta, but then when he gets to Italy. And through the circumstances, we see that he seizes every opportunity to actually represent him to others. So for those of you that may be new to the class, let me just mention that we have on the outline there an outline of what we're going to cover. And what I always like to do is cover some of the material the church actually encourages us to study. And then I have application. And my application today comes from this book by Samuel Rodriguez. Okay, men that were at the men's retreat, remember who spoke? Yeah, Sammy Rodriguez, good friend, spoke there. He's been on the program with me as well. This is a book called Shake Free, How to Deal with the Storms, the Shipwrecks, and Snakes in Your Life. It's really basically taking Acts 27 and 28 and applying it. So a little bit later, I'm going to take some material from his book as we go through that. And again, I'll tell you a little bit more about him in just a minute. Well, let's get into it. And again, if you go to Acts chapter 28, you see that after we were brought safely through, we then learned that the island was called Malta. The native people showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and welcomed us all because it had begun to rain and it was cold. So again, Paul has been through a tremendous storm. They all get thrown into the water or jump into the water. They make it to shore and they build a fire. And so we begin to see what happens there. No one was lost. Everyone survived. Those who could not swim held on to some of the wood. The others that could swim swam to shore. They find themselves there. And interestingly enough, it talks about in verse 2, native people, or some of your translations would say barbarians. But you understand that the Greek word really just meant ignorant of the Greek. Today, barbarian means, you know, well, like Conan the Barbarian. You know, that's the kind of the mindset you get if you ever watched an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. But there, it just simply meant that they weren't Greek-speaking individuals. So don't take that if your translation says barbarians. And so this was actually different than the rest of the Roman Empire, because Malta actually was controlled by the Phoenicians and only later had come under rule of the Romans. So they are less likely have to have spoken the language of most of the Roman Empire. And interestingly enough, I think Luke is using this as an illustration. A Roman soldier looking down on them would see them as barbarians. They would see these as less significant individuals. And here the irony is now that these Roman soldiers and these sailors are actually in need. And who's providing it? These lowly individuals. These outcasts. And Sammy Rodriguez makes some points about that in his book, which we'll get to a little bit later. So they welcome these strangers and they build a fire to help them warm up from the ocean. And as they're gathering the sticks, it's like, can this just get any worse? He's been in the water. He is wet. He has, you know, been through a shipwreck. As they picks it up, Paul is bitten on the hand by a snake. Hence the idea of the storm, shipwrecks, and snakes in your life. And at this point, the natives, being superstitious, are convinced that this is an evidence of the fact that God is bringing judgment on this individual. And yet we see that he just shakes the snake off. No big deal. And now they go from thinking that he is somebody that God has condemned to actually thinking maybe he's a god. But from a Christian point of view, we can point to God's will at this particular point, because he's not running away from his fate, like, say, Jonah was, but instead is being preserved by God's hand through the storms, the shipwrecks, the natural disasters, and even the snakes. Sammy Rodriguez even starts his one chapter there saying, snakes, why did it have to be snakes? Where does that come from? Of course, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. But anyway, let's go on to a little bit. He shakes it from his hand. He's not shaken by the experience. And this is why they then begin to think, God's judgment is not on him. God's hand must be on him. Maybe he's even a God himself. And so, of course, he tries to clarify what is taking place. But even in the midst of one more disaster, because at some point, you got to think, Paul's saying, really, after all the other things I've been through now, even collecting some firewood, I get a snake bite. But again, it's one more way in which God shows his power through the Apostle Paul. And so they're actually hosted warmly by one individual, Publius. And he is a name that is used later on. Interesting enough, when the Federalist Papers were written, they actually used the name Publius. So that's a name that shows up sometimes in literature. But nevertheless, he is a man that owns plural land. So he's obviously very wealthy. And as a result, he is able to heal the father, who has what probably was a bacteria-borne illness, which apparently plagued the island. We learn a lot about Malta through some of the ancient literature, and I just wanted to bring a little of that from some of the commentaries here. But Paul prays for him, God heals him, and now there's a greater opportunity for ministry. All of a sudden, this person that has a shipwreck, and they're not sure about, first of all, survives a snake bite and then heals the most wealthy, perhaps the most wealthy person on the island's father. And so this provides a context for ministry. And Paul once again takes it as an opportunity. And so then as we go down to verse 10, look at verse 10 here. It then says, they also honored us greatly, and when we were about to sail, they put on board whatever we needed. So he's now been there ministering those many months, and as it is time for them to leave, then they want to again show their appreciation for him. And we can see how once again, even in this tragedy, even in this circumstance where it would have been really easy for a lot of us, if this had happened to us, to say, gosh, you know, I'm just trying to make it to Rome so I can be exonerated and end up with a shipwreck and all the other things. This is another place where God brings and uses Paul to bring great fruit to Malta. And if you watched our video last week, Malta is really a Christian island. Now, it's pretty much Catholic, but still, you know, it's very Christianized in a very unusual island in the Mediterranean, which is pretty much post-Christian, but not that particular island. And so we can see even to the 21st century, some of the fruit that continues on there. And so, again, we don't record any explicit examples of conversion in the scriptures, but the seeds were sown, whether they became Christians while he was there or later, we certainly see that it's become kind of this Christianized island. Then we have verses 11 and following, Paul now arriving in Rome. And we can make Christ known through fellowship with other believers is kind of the theme that runs through this. And so they board another ship. Obviously, the other one was destroyed. And again, interestingly enough, notice what he records here in verse 11. The ship of Alexander with the twin gods as a figurehead, putting in at Syracuse, they stayed there for 3 days. These twin gods, apparently, were those which were specifically carved into the ship to protect their voyage. And so, in some respects, he's mentioning this just to simply show that if the Romans' pagan ideas of religion were really accurate, Paul's original ship wouldn't have been wrecked in the first place. So Luke puts this in there just to remind them that they have these figureheads. You've seen ships before that will have various figureheads, and those are supposed to protect them from a storm. But it didn't work for the previous ship, and it's just an illustration again that they were trusting in the wrong things. They weren't entrusting in the God of the universe. They were trusting in their pagan gods. So they finally reach Rome. Welcomed by the local Christians, some of whom were already had heard about Paul, either from his letters or from some of the traveling missionaries. So we can see that the gospel is spreading even in places where Paul has never actually been. And so this fellowship now greatly encourages him just at the right time. And finally, he stepped ashore so that he can eventually plead his case before Caesar. And so verses 17 and following, we see then exactly what is taking place. The theme I put here is that Christians are called to faithfully display Christ-like culture. And so we can begin to see that they gathered together the local leaders of the Jews. And when they had gathered, he said to them, "Brothers, though I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they examined me, they wished to set me at liberty because there was no reason for the death penalty in my case. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, though I had no charge to bring against my nation." And so he once again finds himself in a situation having to defend himself against the Jews, and of course having to defend himself against the Romans. He's still under house arrest, but he at least has an opportunity to call together these Jewish leaders and once again talk about the fact that I am blameless. And notice how he uses the word "our." By this time now, he's pretty much obviously a Christian, who is identified as a Christian, who is part of the sect known as the Way. Shortly thereafter, they come to be known as Christians and separated from Jews. But notice how here he still uses this inclusive word "our." You know, he's still trying to build a bridge, even at this hour, to the non-Christian Jewish community, if you will. And so he's trying to use any commonality of history and culture and Jewish experience to continue to reach out to those Jewish individuals that are in Rome themselves. And he states his innocence in two ways. We can see this. First of all, he declares that he has done nothing wrong against the Jews. And he reports that the Romans had found him as well innocent of breaking law that would deserve punishment, the death penalty. And then he kind of walks the line between rejecting the Jews' accusations, but also trying to not speak against them. And so it's kind of a conciliatory speech. So we're in the last days of Paul's life. But even in the last days of Paul's life, we still see him wanting to reach out to the Jewish community. As we end this chapter, we'll see that he recognizes that, in some respects, I've been appointed to reach out to the Gentiles because I simply have not been able to break through the spiritual blindness of the Jews. But you can see that he's still providing a bridge for ministry. Even as we think about Harvest America, don't you love the challenge today from Greg Laurie? Just think about some non-Christian you know right now, and instead of going to the movies, or instead of going to a picnic, grab that individual and invite them to AT&T Stadium. Let's keep trying to build the bridge to individuals that maybe we need to be the words and the life of Jesus to them. Some people said that the only Bible some people will ever read is you. They may never pick up a Bible. They may never read a Bible. What they know about Christianity is how you live. And here, Paul is once again providing a platform, trying to provide a bridge to reach out to the Jewish community. And so he sees a successful first step in the conversion with the local leaders. I'm kind of interested in wanting to know a little bit more about this sect of Judaism. And it's interesting to note that he's essentially starting with a blank slate in their eyes because they haven't been in Jerusalem. They haven't been in Caesarea. They haven't been in some of the other places in Asia Minor. And so they invite him to speak more about his beliefs so they can learn about this new faith that's stirring up controversy. And no doubt, we have no record in Scripture, but no doubt it's quite likely that because of that, he left some other Jews who had converted to Christianity who are left in the Roman Empire. Finally, then we see in the last few verses here that God uses the message of the gospel throughout the world. And so as Luke is winding down this long letter, this long epistle, this long description of the Acts of the Apostles, he reminds us of the fact that we are going to continue this on. Because if you think about it, you look at the last couple of words in the book of Acts, it doesn't really end with the execution of Paul. It sort of ends with the idea that Paul is still preaching, and the apostles are still preaching, and the disciples are still preaching, and here in the 21st century, we're still adding, if you will, to the book of Acts. It's one of those kind of ongoing messages. And so we see here, first of all, in verse 23, that a large number of guests can now get together in a rental home that is used by Paul to actually proclaim the gospel. And so once again, we see how in every particular situation, God provides a platform. In Malta, he begins to befriend perhaps one of the richest people on the island and leads individuals perhaps to the Lord, but certainly cures his father. Here we see now you have this rental home that is opened up and another large platform for him to begin to speak. And then Luke records a summary of his teaching points, which again just remind us of some of the things we've already read in the book of Acts when Paul was with Barnabas in Antioch, when Paul was with Peter in Jerusalem, and kind of a great way to kind of summarize some of the things that we've been learning over these many months. Paul then concludes his time with an audience by reflecting on this vision from Isaiah. If you're taking some notes, you might put down Isaiah chapter 6, because what is so interesting here is that he quotes a number of verses 8 to 10 from Isaiah, and again talks about the fact that this was the vision that the prophet Isaiah had, that God used to deliver judgment on anyone who rejects his voice. And although that was used in the Old Testament in that context that Isaiah was speaking to those particular Jewish believers, now Paul uses it to talk about those who would reject the gospel message here in the New Testament times. And Jesus himself, interesting enough, refers to that. If you're taking some notes, you might put down not only Isaiah 6, but Luke chapter 8. So we see that Isaiah gives the prophecy, Jesus uses it, and then finally Paul uses it in one of his last messages that we have recorded in Scripture. And again, it's the idea that we have individuals who hear the gospel, but they reject the gospel. They have ears, but they don't hear. And so as a result, it's looking for those people that have open ears and, in particular, open eyes that can hear and see the gospel and reap, don't you love the word, harvest of good fruit from the seeds that are planted. And finally, he concludes his time of sharing by declaring that God's message of salvation has been rejected by the Jewish people. You read that certainly in his letter to the church in Rome, and now he finds himself in Rome. And this, again, is one of the great challenges, because Paul, to his dying day, was hoping to reach the Jewish people, but there is a spiritual blindness. So instead, what we see is, as he speaks with the hope that the Gentile nations will hear about Jesus, come to believe in him, and spread the gospel throughout the world. And as we wind down Acts 28, isn't that exactly what has taken place? It has not been the Jews, in most cases, that have spread the gospel. It has been the Gentiles that have spread the gospel. And as I conclude here, you know, it's tempting to sometimes think, as we look at the book of Acts, to say, well, this is really the story of Paul. But Luke writes it in such a way to really say it really isn't. Because if this were a book about defending Paul, then you think you would wrap this biography with one of the more significant ending events of Paul's life, which is what? His execution under Nero. And it's just left open-ended. I mean, it just ends. And, of course, there's pretty good evidence to suggest that this was written before he was executed anyway. If you watched the movie that we as a class went to see, you know, you had the manuscripts being sent out before Paul had actually been executed, and he was being executed while the manuscripts were being sent out. And that's the way they did it as a literary device, but it may have been indeed that the case. But instead, Luke leaves the reader with this kind of open-ended statement. What do we have here? I think it's so interesting. He lived there 2 whole years at his own expense and welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus with all boldness and without hindrance. So again, he records all of that, but the reality is that it's open-ended, and that is, we are to carry that on. Jew or Gentile, as believers, we are to take the gospel to the ends of the earth. And so again, it's been a long road, but we have finally made it to the end of the book of Acts. And so it's fun to see that. But what I wanted to try to do for a few minutes, since we have some time, is to take a couple of these great principles from this book by Sammy Rodriguez. I guess I should call Samuel Rodriguez, but one of those of us know him, call him Sammy. If you're not familiar, he grew up in Pennsylvania, Puerto Rican family. He is now a pastor of a very significant church in Sacramento, California. He's also the president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference. And if you might say, that name sounds familiar. Yes, he is the one that offered the prayer at Donald Trump's inauguration and spoke at the men's conference. And he mentioned at the men's conference, the last time I interviewed him, I talked about it as well. I said, before you were to pray at Donald Trump's inauguration, the press kept asking you a question. The question was that, are you going to use that name? In other words, are you going to pray in Jesus? And he said, and he'd always play dumb. He said, what name do you think that would be? What word would that be? And of course, if you actually watched the inauguration with everybody there, he prays what? In Jesus' name. And so again, it was just a wonderful opportunity. And he tells the story that this is not the kind of thing growing up in a Puerto Rican family in Pennsylvania that you would expect that you would ever be doing. When he was a youth pastor in Allentown, there was nobody that would suggest that he would be as successful as he is today. But you know what? I think J.D. Guru, when he was going to Word of Life, probably didn't think that he was going to be the president of the Southern Baptist Convention either. But what I thought I would do is take you through just a couple of key points here. If nothing else, I got a feeling everybody's going to run to the bookstore and buy this book because it's got some great material in there. But first of all, he talks about that as Paul is on the ship, it reminds us of a question that as a father, and if you were a parent, or even if you were a kid, you know the question, are we there yet? And there is a sense in which Paul must have wondered how many times after being arrested, waiting in Caesarea for 2 years, having two trials, getting on a ship, facing a life-threatening storm, surviving a shipwreck, and then getting a snake bite, what in the world God was doing and how that fits so very well with indeed what was going on there. And through all the twists and turns, Paul knew that he would eventually get to Rome. Here's what he says. Through all these twists and turns, however, Paul knew that he would eventually get to Rome because that's where God wanted him to be. Far from being a vacation destination, the center of the Roman Empire was probably one of the most dangerous places in the world for Paul. Now known as the Eternal City because of its ties to ancient history and its timeless works of art and architecture, in Paul's day, Rome was not only the capital, but also the center of the most powerful military empire on the planet. Consequently, Rome served as the United Nations of the early first century because of its diverse population, a result of the expansive conquest of so many tribes and nations. England, Spain, Syria, Israel, and much of what we now know as Western Europe and Northern Africa all belonged within Rome's grasp, and at the time, all the roads literally led to Rome. And in some respects, we see, first of all, the perseverance of making it to Rome. Well, we also see God's plan, because imagine today, if you wanted to reach the world for Christ, one place you could go would be to New York City, the United Nations, or the International Criminal Court, or, some of these other places, European Union, or something like that. And here, if you would put all those together in one location, that's what Rome actually provided for Paul. And then, of course, we read in the book of Acts that he was able to spend years there interacting with people from diverse cultures around the world. And this began to be so significant in terms of the expansion of the gospel around the world. Then, of course, as we point about, that on Paul's ship, it didn't take long for problems to start. As we looked at last week, Acts 27:4, I love the way it says it in the scriptures. The winds were against us. And he warned them about the possible dangers as we talked about last week, but they continued on just the same. And so it says the ship was caught by the storm and they could not head into the wind, so they gave way to it and were driven along. He goes on to, and this is where he talks about something else that we might want to get into. And that is, if you've ever read Sebastian Younger's best-selling book, The Perfect Storm, or have seen the movie, Paul's caught in a hurricane force called the Nor'eastern and was swept out to sea. He says, maybe you've read Sebastian Junger's best-selling book, The Perfect Storm, or seen the film version. Both describe the true tale of the fishing ship Andrea Gale, which vanished, leaving no survivors during an epic once-in-a-century storm off the coast of Massachusetts in 1991. He says, I mention this tragic tale because I continue to think of the movie whenever I read this account of Paul's plight. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called a nor'easter swept down the island. And so he begins to talk about again that here he actually recognized that his journey might have to take place without a ship. Imagine the ship in the middle of the Mediterranean, or imagine if you've ever been on a cruise ship, you know, in the Caribbean or someplace else, you realize after a while you look out, my only safety is right here. And just imagine the only safety you have tearing apart. And so in some respects, it was just a reminder that sometimes you have to make it without a ship. And he goes on to talk about how sometimes we depend upon certain things for our safety. It's your job. It's your home. It's your family relations, whatever. And sometimes God shakes every bit of it up. And again, J.D. Greer, thank you for the connection. Look what happened to Job. Everything was taken except his wife. I love that line about the wife, but we'll leave that alone, won't we? if nothing else, and taken from him. And just think of everything that you really depend on in terms of your security, in terms of your identity, and all of that is taken away from Paul. And here, just a reminder that sometimes we have to recognize what actually is most important as well. So, kind of trapped into, as he says, a doozy of a storm, Paul and his shipmates had to throw the cargo and tackle overboard. It's one thing to start throwing the wheat overboard, because they do say they threw over wheat. Probably they were throwing over caskets of olive oil and who knows what else. But you just throw the tackle overboard, and later they even cut loose the lifeboat. You know, it's kind of the whole idea that sometimes we have to lighten our load. And I love this as well. He says, my old tennis racket from high school, a wobbly shed that hadn't seen a snowy hillside in years, boxes of textbooks, a set of china from my wife's great aunt, three kids' backpacks in various states of deterioration, one spare tire, and three bicycles. It's amazing what you can accumulate in your garage and attic, let alone the rest of your house over the years, but there's something about moving from one home to another that forces you to let go of things. It's rarely easy, at least from my experience, but when my young family moved from Pennsylvania to California many years ago, it felt as if we were preparing for an expedition to Mount Everest. There were items we chose to take because they were useful, such as beds, mattresses, chairs, our sofa, and our kitchen table. Then we packed our kids, wanting to hold on to favorite toys, stuffed animals, homemade artwork, practical necessities from the kitchen, dishes, pots and pans, certainly. But he says, our list of items to move grew until one day I sat down with Eva and said, this is crazy. We can't take all this stuff with us. We've got to focus on essentials. This is our chance to start over and get more organized. She agreed, but it was easier said than done. What if we needed that snowblower in Sacramento? Couldn't it snow there sometimes? What if one of the kids wanted to take boxing lessons down the road? Shouldn't we keep the punching bag and gloves somebody gave us? He goes on and just reminds us that just as we accumulate stuff, sometimes we accumulate activities in our lives. And so some of the books he mentions, if you wanted to read some of minimalism, I should say, Living a Meaningful Life and Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up are just a couple of the books he mentions. But whether it's the accumulation of stuff or, since it's the summer, the accumulation of activities. You know, a lot of people say that their days and activities go from January to December. But I'm finding more and more of us, they really go from September to June. Summer is a time where you reevaluate, especially if you had kids in school, but even if you don't have kids, it's before you start again in the fall, you start saying, maybe I'm doing too many things. And there's a wonderful book came out a couple of years ago. It's entitled Pruning Your Activity Tree. You know, we actually see that we have our trunk, then we have our limbs that represent the different aspects of our life. Our business, our family, our hobbies, and the rest. But then you have these ever proliferating little twigs out there. And sometimes in order to get new growth, you have to prune back the activity tree. And again, he talks about the fact that sometimes there's a place where just as they were throwing things overboard, sometimes we, especially during the summer when we can reevaluate our priorities, need to reevaluate the things that we have, the things that we own, which sometimes own us, but also reevaluate some of our activities as well. Well, one more real quickly. Also, I thought this was kind of interesting as well. If you survive the storm, you can shake the snake. And he talks about all the Bible is filled with all sorts of strange and miraculous kinds of events. Had Paul gone through horrible ordeals through his life and survived a shipwreck and a snake fastened itself on his hand and he just shook it off. And what he says is that what was interesting after this is he's around these individuals from the Romans perspective, probably were individuals that were sort of lower class. They were, if you will, some of those individuals who you would refer to as underdogs. And I love what he says here. Have you attended any of your high school or college class reunions? He said, I've been to only a couple. And from my limited experience, they're definitely full of surprises. Former classmates don't always turn out to be the people we imagined they would be. Perhaps the student voted most likely to succeed ended up as the manager of the local Red Lobster. A fine job, but not what everyone expected. On the other hand, the scruffy kid who got bullied as the butt of class jokes may have started a dot-com company right after college and sold it to Google 5 years later for millions of dollars. And the pretty cheerleader with the perfect body? Well, like the rest of us, she's put on a few pounds like the plain Jane no one asked to the prom blossomed into a beautiful person both inside and out. And the point is that he's talking about how there were individuals that certainly made some bad choices. Even there, he uses the example of the people in Malta expected Paul, after getting snake bit, to swell up and die. And so a lot of people sometimes expect that you aren't going to be very successful as well. Here's what he said. The people watching Paul expected him to swell up and die after the snake bite. The people watching you may be expecting you to quit your job, file for divorce, declare bankruptcy, stop pursuing your degree, or give up hope. My friend, they're in for a huge surprise when they look up and see what God is doing in your life. They won't be able to explain how you got promoted instead of fired, how your marriage is stronger than ever despite the gossip, and how you got out of debt, started your own business, or returned to church. And so again, he just hopes that we will, as Christians, stick with what God has called us to do. Persevere as Paul has persevered and understand how key it is for us to recognize that, as I said before, we're the only Bible some people will ever watch. And they will determine whether or not Christianity is true or false depending on how you react to the very circumstances that J.D. Greer talked about today. So anyway, this is a book that has come out most recently by Samuel Rodriguez, Shake Free. It's in our library there. It's also in our bookstore. And if nothing else, just one more way to take what we've been learning over these many weeks from the book of Acts and apply it to your life. Parker?